From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
I've been captivated by a historical biography lately, the subject of which is not a person, but a tree, a species with a life story spanning nearly 250,000 years and much of the globe. The main character is the venerable and distinctive ginkgo, and its biographer is my guest today on the show. The book from Yale University Press is simply called Ginkgo, and its author is Peter Crane, former director of the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew, and current dean and professor in the School of Forestry at Environmental Studies at Yale. Welcome to the show, Peter Crane. How are you?
Very good. Thank you, Margaret. Great to be with you.
Yes, and I've read maybe that you have an exciting new adventure coming up, that you're moving on to a new adventure next year.
I am. I'm looking forward to that, but I still have a few things to do here at the school, which has been great.
Yes.
Wonderful.
Yes. So the book, which has been fascinating, and it really does read like a biography, a sort of a biography and history combined, it begins with the first ginkgo that made its mark on you, one that stood near your home on the Kew grounds when you were there. It's kind of an astonishing story, that tree. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the oldest ginkgos in Europe, certainly one of the oldest in England, and it dates from the early 1760s. So, you know, that makes it 250-plus years old, and it's a great, you know, one of the great legendary trees of Kew. It's what we used to call one of the old lions, one of the original trees that dated from the foundation of the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew, by Princess Augusta in the late 1750s. And it was probably obtained from a nurseryman in working in East London at the time, and somehow he was getting plants from the East, from China, possibly from Japan. And there are a number of trees on the Kew site, of which the ginkgo is one, that came from those early introductions. And so it's a magnificent old tree. And so, you know, it really is one of our most precious trees on the Kew grounds. It was one that we always worried about, you know, when there was a big storm or something. This was a precious tree for us.
It was astonishing to me that that tree not only was known to you when you were the director there much more recently, but the first director of Kew was that William Jackson Hooker, who was there in the 1840s, that he knew that tree as well.
Absolutely. He would have known that tree, all of the directors of Kew.
And
they come and go over the years, and I'm one of the ones that's come and gone. They all have known that tree, and it would have been planted, you know, a good 70, 80 years before Hooker was even appointed.
Yeah.
It was planted when it was a royal estate, actually, which is when Kew started.
So many other esteemed botanists and tree experts, plant explorers, have had sort of a ginkgo chapter in their careers, and the book is filled with wonderful tales of them. And, you know, some of them have the sort of supporting cast around this great tree in the book, have names that I know, not from having known until I read your book. I didn't know their stories as much as I recognize their names because they've become the species names, the specific epithets that describe some plants that I know. So names like camphor and Siebold and Thunberg.
Yes.
Yeah, so all of these names were kind of brought to life for me in the story of the ginkgo.
Yeah, I mean, I think those three characters in particular are three fascinating characters in the history of plant exploration more broadly, not just in the history of ginkgo. All three of them were physician botanists to the Dutch East India Company, based in southern Japan, actually in Nagasaki Harbor at a small island called Deshima. And for several hundred years, this location was the only contact that Japan really had with the West. Mm. And these three botanists, one Kempfer, who was there in the 1690s, and Thunberg, who was there, I think, in the 1770s, and then Siebold, who was there in the 1820s, were kind of close observers of Japanese life as a whole, but also close observers of Japanese plant life. And it was Kempfer who first noticed and described and named Ginkgo, as he transliterated it from the Japanese. But Thunberg saw it, and then Siebold did a magnificent illustration of it when he returned home from Japan in his Flora Japonica, published in the 1820s.
Mm. It's a botanical oddity, this tree, in many ways. And I think you say in the book it's sort of a bit of the platypus of the plant world, as you write.
Yeah.
So can we talk a little bit about the oddities that it represents?
Yeah, so rather like the platypus, the oddity comes in its sort of reproductive system. You know, the platypus is a mammal, but curiously is not giving birth to live young, is laying eggs. So that's kind of a bit strange for a mammal. And what that is a kind of holdover from the reptilian ancestors of mammals.
Mm-hmm.
And ginkgo has a kind of similar story because during its reproductive process, the last little phase of it is that there are swimming sperm cells produced by the pollen grains. And swimming sperm cells is not something you would see in a normal tree. This is something you would see in a moss or in a fern. So in a way, it's just like the platypus. It's a holdover of an ancestral feature that hasn't quite changed yet. And when that was discovered, actually it was discovered by a Japanese scientist in the last few years of the 19th century. I mean, it was an astonishing discovery because no one really expected it. And it's part of what sort of contributes to why botanists in particular are interested in this strange, peculiar, isolated tree that's so different from all the other trees we have.
So that's one way that it's different. And then I think there's another passage in the book where it says, it's the only member in its genus, the only genus in its family, the only family in its order, which is the only order in its subclass. So it's a loner.
It's totally a loner. And, you know, I always say, you know, there are five different groups of seed plants, and one of those groups is ginkgo. You know, in some
right.
of the other groups, flowering plants, there's 350,000 species contrasted to ginkgo, where there's just one species.
So in five groups of seed plants, it's one of the groups all unto itself.
All unto itself,
ah,
yeah.
Okay.
So there'd only be four if we'd lost ginkgo.
And now there are, you were speaking a little bit about its reproductive habits. There are separate male and female
there are.
Ginkgos, yeah?
There are male and female trees, which is not so unusual. I mean, yew trees also have male and female.
Mm-hmm.
But it really kind of matters in the case of ginkgo. I was just looking at some ginkgos this past weekend, and the leaves are mainly off the trees now. And so you can see the fruits, or the seeds is what they are in correct botanical parlance. And the seeds, some of these ginkgo trees produce vast quantities of seed. That's just on the female, of course. And then the seeds drop, and then the seeds smell. The seeds have a terrible,
they do.
Terrible putrid odor that they produce, particularly at this time of the year as they hit the ground and start to rot.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, probably that smell is something to do with the way those seeds are dispersed or were dispersed in the past. But it's not the kind of tree you like to have growing outside your front door.
Not a female, at least, yeah.
Not a female.
Yeah. Now, where do we think it? So I mentioned in the introduction approximately 250, no, wait a minute, it's 250 million. Is it,
that's correct.
Million
right,
years
billion.
Ago.
Yeah.
Where does it, where do we think that it began on the Earth?
We don't really know where
yeah.
it began, but what we do know from the fossil record, and because the leaves are so distinctive, it's easy to spot in the fossil record, we have it in both the southern hemisphere and in the northern hemisphere and on all of the continents. So you see it in South America, you see it in Australia, you see it in Antarctica, you see it in India, but you also see it in East Asia, in Europe, in North America. So this was a widespread plant. And in fact, between about 200 and 100 million years ago, we know that there were multiple different kinds of ginkgo, all with basically the same kind of leaf, but some subtle differences in the form of the leaf and some subtle differences too in the seeds and the way the seeds were born. So we know that once there were many species of ginkgo-like plants on the planet, and today we just have the one.
I love the some of the images in the book of the living fossils, the pictures of impressions that leaves had made. And I think there were examples from Afghanistan, Scotland, North Dakota. Is that right? North Dakota.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. And now, have you gone around the world and visited? Do you go on ginkgo adventures?
Well, I have done some looking both at living trees and at fossils. But usually, when I see the fossils, I'm collecting more broadly than just looking for ginkgos. But I have collected ginkgo in North Dakota. I've collected it in Northern England. I've collected it in Mongolia. You know, I've seen it in a bunch of different places. This was a widespread plant, which is kind of all the more paradoxical that today we just have this one living species left.
It is. I think there's a timeline diagram that I saw on sort of the origin of plants in general, and the ginkgo is, what is it, older than the conifers but younger than cycads. Is that correct? Somewhere in there.
Yeah, it's you know, it goes back, as you said, to about 250 million years, which makes it older than most of the trees that we're familiar with, flowering plant trees. It's a little younger, perhaps, than the conifer lineage, but older than most of the familiar conifer genera that we know, and around the same age as cycads, but significantly older than most of the forest trees that we're familiar with.
Now, the cycads, they have, I remember many years ago interviewing a botanist at the New York Botanical Garden who was the cycad expert, at Dennis Stevenson, and I remember he said the phrase to me, he pointed and he said, they have motile male gametes, he said. So what you were talking about before,
exactly.
The swimming sperm of these plants, yeah?
Exactly.
Yeah.
In fact, when this was first discovered, it was first discovered in ginkgo by a man called Sakuguro Hirase, working at the University of Tokyo in about 1898. And then remarkably, in the same year, another Japanese botanist, also working in Tokyo, discovered exactly the same phenomenon in cycads. And they're the only two groups that it occurs in.
Mm.
Don't see that in conifers. We don't see that in any normal flowering plant tree, but we do see it in cycads and ginkgo. So they're the same in that respect, in holding over this kind of primitive water-reliant mode of reproduction.
Right. It was a watery world, yeah?
Yes, exactly.
Yes, it was indeed. So another oddity kind of that you cite is you say that the ginkgo has the most synchronized leaf drop of any tree I know. Tell me about that.
Oh, that's lovely. And again, you know, at this time of year in the fall, this is the time when they're dropping their leaves. And it's not always true, but it's very often the case that a very large proportion of the leaves on a ginkgo tree, which, of course, are brimstone yellow in the autumn sunlight, you know, a huge proportion of those leaves come down on one night. So I was back in Chicago a week or so ago. We had a big snowstorm, and then after the snow had settled, the next night, many of the ginkgo trees, that was their night, and they dropped the leaves, and
right.
So you had this wonderful white snow, and then these beautiful, this carpet of yellow leaves under every ginkgo tree, and they are absolutely stunning. And, you know, at this time of year, those leaves are magnificent. And when they all come down at once, you have this incredible carpet of yellow around the bases of the trees.
Yes. So mankind has been cultivating the ginkgo, I think I read, for about 1,000 years. And it has many places in various cultures around the world, including, as you note in the book, some pretty obscure ones. I think you mentioned something about the sumo wrestler's ponytail.
Yes, I mean, it's such a, you know, this little fan-shaped leaf that it has is, you know, has been taken up in all kinds of ways, but particularly in Japanese culture, but also in Korean and Chinese cultures. And so the shapes of things that are kind of fan-shaped like that are often referred back to the ginkgo. I love one of the old common names for ginkgo in the Chinese literature is duck's foot.
Duck's foot.
And that, again, refers to the sort of shape of the leaf, you know, the kind of webbed leaf of versus the kind of webbed foot of a duck. So that this idea of the ginkgo leaf shape has found its way into various cultures, particularly in the East.
The arts and crafts movement, even, yes?
Yes, absolutely. And, it was certainly taken up in the arts and crafts movement, and you see it in arts and decorated on the side of houses, decorated on vases, on prints. It's such a beautiful, a common motif. And I think it gained quite a bit of impetus from Goethe's engagement with the tree, too, which is an interesting story in itself.
Tell me a little bit about that, then.
So Goethe, early, in the early 19th century, so I think in around about 1815, wrote a very famous poem called Ginkgo Biloba. Mm-hmm. And he wrote this poem to a young lady who he was very fond of, and he pasted onto the bottom of his letter two dried ginkgo leaves. And he asks in the poem, is this one leaf joined together as two, or is this one leaf divided in two, or is this two leaves joined together as one?
Mm.
It's a very, very famous poem in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the part of the interest, particularly in Europe, and particularly in the German-speaking world, comes in ginkgo, flows not only from its botanical interest and the beauty of its leaves, but also it's kind of its association with Goethe, which is very important, I think.
Hmm. As you note in the book, ginkgo is a plant of parks, gardens, or city streets, all human-created habitats. So even though there was this very relatively small gene pool left of all the from all the lineage of the ginkgo, we've managed, you also say, to come up with more than 200 cultivars of ginkgo today. Are there really that many?
So many.
So I'd love to hear about what's your basic generic ginkgo versus what are some of these cultivars? You know, talk about them as if I'm going to make room for a tree in my garden, or listeners are. Let's talk about some of them as plants for the landscape.
Yeah, so I think there are various things that you can focus on when you're thinking about a ginkgo cultivar. One is the kind of ultimate shape of the tree. What do you want the shape of the tree to be like?
Right.
So there are kind of tall, thin ones. That are kind of appropriate for kind of narrow spaces. One of these is often planted in cities is called a Princeton Century. But there are others that are kind of short and more shrubby, and there are others that are more spreading. So there are a range of different habit types to suit different situations. And then there are also different leaf types. There are variegated ginkgos. There are kind of cut-leafed ginkgos, like you might have a cut-leafed oak. There are leaves where the leaf is not properly unrolled, and they look like little trumpets. So there are also some variation, not only in the habit, but also in the leaf form. And these are all basically, vegetatively reproduced selections from mutations that have been picked up in seedlings. And across the street from my office, there's a female tree, and there's lots of little ginkgo seedlings coming up underneath the tree. And some proportion of them have slightly different leaves. So the way these varieties have been propagated and brought into the trade is by selecting those mutants.
How big can a ginkgo get? How big are some of the old timers, and what is the general size of a ginkgo tree, if not one of these cultivars?
I think when you see these big trees in Japan, they can be very large indeed, well over 100 feet tall, and even much bigger than that, and big spreading trees. So they can reach quite an enormous size, and of course they're quite... We think that they're quite long-lived also. So, they can become an absolutely massive tree. But I think, the ones that are planted here in gardens in the right situation can become a really pretty good-sized tree. They're not a slow-growing tree. They're not a especially fast-growing tree. They're a kind of middle-of-the-road kind of tree. But over time, they put on a lot of growth, and they can become quite sizable. And you know, you often see both in Japan, and I've seen also in New York, that you know, they sometimes need a lot of kind of pruning and pollarding to kind of keep them under control, which is why in the streets, you know, they prefer something like these tall, thin ones that that don't spread too much.
Like the Princeton Sentry, you
said. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I see. And so as a street tree, those are more desirable then, perhaps?
I think so, particularly if you've not got a lot of space for it to expand. And in Japan, you often see them pollarded extremely severely. You know, cut right back, but it's an incredibly tough and resilient tree. It'll produce new growth every year, which then will also need cutting back.
So we have a few minutes left, and I wanted to hear more about what you describe in the book as sometimes when the trees age, they have almost stalactite-like growth.
Yeah.
Tell me about these eight, because I've never seen a very old one, and you've been privileged to see some. What is that? How does
so these are. As far as we know, these are pretty much like normal branches, but instead of growing upwards, they grow downwards.
Huh.
And then when they hit the ground, they send up sucker shoots.
Mm.
So in a way, you can think of it as a sort of form of vegetative reproduction. It's a way that new suckers are propagated. And you don't tend to see it very much in North American trees. Occasionally, you will see it. I have seen it occasionally in North American trees, but I think it tends to be a phenomenon of much older trees.
I see.
I don't see it, for example, on that Q tree, which is 250 years old, but I have occasionally seen it in North America. But you see its greatest expression in some of these big old trees in Japan and China. Mm-hmm. And there, the development of these stalactite-like downgrowths is really a pretty striking feature of the tree.
Huh. And is it just a tree of the temperate zone then? Is it inclined, it's not inclined to go beyond there, hotter or colder?
Yes, I think it's a tree very much of the temperate zone. At least the ginkgo that survived to today needs a kind of a cold winter, but it also needs a kind of warm summer to grow really well. So it's perfectly adapted to the middle of the U.S. It starts to not feel cold enough for it, I think, in sort of central and southern Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And even looking at the difference, say, between Houston and Dallas, there's a sort of big difference in how cold the winters are normally there. And ginkgo struggles a bit in Houston, but does better in Dallas. I mean, obviously, it depends on exactly where the tree is growing. But in general, you need a kind of nice, cold, good, hard winter. It finds Chicago just fine, for example. But, of course, even ginkgo has its limits. So while it'll grow in Toronto, you know, there are limits to how far north in Canada it will grow. It needs a good growing season to really put on a good amount of growth. And it needs water, too, of course.
Right. Well, I'm inspired to start to research some of these cultivars that you mention in the book. For my garden, I've never grown a ginkgo, I will have to confess. I'm so glad to speak to you, Peter Crane, about your book, Ginkgo, and about the ginkgo tree in general. Thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you, Margaret.
And thanks to all of you for joining me. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher or iTunes. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or on Facebook at facebook.com/awaytogarden. Happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.